Welcome to today's podcast, It's Worth Considering. Does it seem to you that life is a bit out of control? Well, if you think so, you're not alone. This short podcast is to help all of us consider the teachings of Christ, even in these out of control times. I am Pastor David, the assistant pastor at Bethel Gilead Community Church, also known as the Church on Block Road. My co-host for this discussion is Daniel Anderson. We are going to discuss the deconstruction of faith. In order to deconstruct, one first must have constructed. Have Christians raised in the church actually constructed their faith or simply accepted it without accepting Christ? Scripture makes one wise unto salvation, but does it bring salvation? Hello there, Daniel. How are you?
Hello, David. Pastor David, very good. Thanks for having me back again.
It is good to be back up here in Grand Rapids. I tell you, the sun is, no, it's not shining. It's just like it is back in Bronson and Branch County. Cloudy and depressing. But hey, we have a very uplifting podcast today, don't we?
Absolutely. It's a thing.
It is a thing.
Just like the last one we did, it was a thing.
It is a thing. It is the deconstruction of faith. Now, with that title, you can also understand that, well, maybe I was a bit sarcastic when I'm talking about an uplifting topic, although it can be.
I hope so.
It can be.
Yeah.
So, and I think that, well, the groundwork would be best to, let's describe what is, first of all, deconstruction, just that term itself, kind of implies, well, something that is constructed and then is going to be deconstructed. It's going to be taken apart by its parts. Then to what you do with it afterwards is really, well, are you rebuilding with it or are you just going to scratch it and throw it away? So when we talk about, you know, to deconstruct, you know, that's kind of where we're going to be talking about. But when we talk about deconstruction of the faith, that's kind of a Christian phenomenon, isn't it?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, we could go to the roots of it, get all philosophical about it.
Let's do that, though.
Okay.
You have that background. Where do you see the roots for deconstruction?
You'd want to look at postmodernism, Nietzsche, Derrida, Habermas. Those would be the names you'd want to look at. And it has to do with post-modernity reacting against modernity. So with modernity in all of its positive take on science and the progress of humanity.
Modernity, so yeah. Meeting...
Modernism, relying on science and materialism and logic, you know, philosophical materialism. So, you know, that influenced a lot of our founding of America, too, with John Locke and his roots in modernity. You know, Francis Bacon with science.
Wow. So this kind of goes back philosophically quite a ways.
Yeah.
And probably the most up-to-date or modern, even though it's not really viewed, and I think, in the academic world as seriously as it's kind of lived out today in the social world, is going to be postmodernism, right?
Right.
And that term's thrown around a bit. How would you, in the vernacular sense, describe it? Because I think this deconstruction has to do with that idea.
Yeah, I think fundamentally it's a rejection of the idea of objective truth.
So there is no objective truth then.
Right. It's subjective.
Ah.
And then that came, made its way into biblical hermeneutics too, because if you have like what you learn typically about proper ways of interpreting scripture having to do with, well, what's the context? What were the meanings of the words as they were using them? How would the original audience understand them? And, that's rational.
Yeah. But meaning comes from what you bring to it.
Yeah.
And that the words themselves really have no meaning. That's kind of postmodernism, right?
Right.
The modern world failed us. Really, we saw after World War I,
right,
and World War II, everything that the modern world promised really kind of fell on its face. So
right.
Let's postmodern. Let's look at something different. So let's construct meaning not as objective, but simply subjective, what I bring to it.
Yeah. Same thing with our Constitution, you know, the conservative versus liberal or progressive take. On the one hand, there's the Constitution, which you have to understand what the framers meant by the words, so you have to study some history. So that tethers us to our Constitution with the subjective meaning as best as we can discern versus, no, you know, it's a living, breathing document.
Yeah, so those are the two contrasting views. Is there a place in the middle for that, though?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, on the one hand, we understand that we all do have our biases. That's true. But to what extent are you able to bracket those and come to a fair-minded interpretation of things?
So when
we have to agree that our subjectivity does, you know, what are our desires? Why is it we want to know? All these personal things, of course they come to the table, and we're human and we can't not be human when we're studying scripture or
right,
whatever.
We can kind of remove ourselves as much as we can by implementing certain known approaches, right?
Right.
It can be to literature, it can be to when we look at history. Let's put ourselves in the mindset of those at the time as best we can and understand it for its historical content. But are we stuck in the past? Or can we say, here's the historical context, but this is what we bring to it now, so many years later, so much water underneath the bridge, and can meaning from this be now applied to give it new meaning?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, we can do amendments to our Constitution so we can realize, okay, maybe there's some things the framers didn't have right, but they provided a way for us to change those things as needs change, right?
Sure.
But that's still within a very objective kind of a hermeneutic where you're interpreting texts and you believe you can get the meaning to them, and you and I could say, hey, wait a minute, okay, you're right. I'm bringing my prejudices to the table too much. I'm not giving it a fair reading. I'm not reading it as it's understood. Well, anyway, with postmodernism, though, that project itself, like all learning and all truth, simply is a matter of power. So education, it's a matter of power. If I'm the teacher and I'm in this institution, I've got power to shape the minds of my students. Why? For my political ends. And that's fine, because that's all there is. Everything is political.
So, you know, fidelity, right? Integrity, those are really important pieces to be able to fairly to get at an objective and meaningful meaning are going to be needed. Now,
you would think, but that's exactly what the postmodernists, and as it was expressed through, critical theory, which is Marxist, it's exactly what they deny. So any attempt at saying, here's the objective meaning of Scripture or of the Constitution or any of that, really, it's nothing but a power grab, because that's all there is power, the pursuit of power, politics. Everything is political.
So is this happening today in the church? If we take this idea of, you know, postmodern perspective and stuff and then take it to in the mindset of pastors or priests or those in religious authority, is it a power grab?
Well, that's what the postmodernist would say, and so they want to get away from authority because that's, you know, like the patriarchy and this idea of, hey, there's the subjective truth we need to teach you so that you can see it for yourself, so that you can follow along. Ah, gotcha, pastor. You're just trying to control me. Like everything, it's a matter of power and politics. So no, I'm spiritual. I'm not religious. I reject.
I think that's really. I mean, we talk about this, and now let's look into Scripture, and let's see. Do we see this happening? I'll put it out there. When Jesus came onto the scene and his teaching, he took the traditional teaching. He questioned them about, you know, Nicodemus. Nicodemus, you are spiritual leader of Israel, and yet you're not understanding what it is to be born again? Why does this take you by surprise? And of course, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they had a corner on the power, the religious power, and also therefore the political power of its time. Did Jesus seek to take back that power?
Well, I think he was talking within the frame of, you know, objectivity, that there is truth, claiming he is the truth. So he wasn't saying, oh, you Pharisees, you Sadducees, coming out of Moses and the prophets, that's part of the patriarchy and the hierarchy. But no, I'm the groovy hippie Jesus, and and I'm here to level the playing field so everything is egalitarian, you know, leveled, equity. And
I mean, he did level the field, right? He was saying, guess what? There's no longer differences between free and slave, between Jew and Gentile. You see where I'm going with this? So I would look at deconstruction of the faith as something that is very common. I think it's been hijacked, and too oftentimes it's been used with a postmodern perspective that we're going to do this to justify whatever we want,
right?
But not necessarily to do this to re-examine and to come to a clearer understanding,
right,
of what the scriptures have to say.
Yeah, so, and I think that's what Jesus was doing with them, is saying, not one jot or tittle will pass, and that he is the fulfillment of the law. So he wasn't dissing the law, dissing Moses and the prophets.
Right.
He was upholding it, but saying he was the realization of it. And you people, you scholars, you should have seen it coming.
Exactly, but they didn't. And that's what's kind of interesting. They missed recognizing Jesus as the Messiah. He came to fulfill, to demonstrate God in flesh, how we are to live. And then he talked about the scriptures of how they should be interpreted with a much deeper perspective than the literal interpretation which they so oftentimes wanted to give it.
Well, I think it's not that he was getting away from a literal interpretation that they were wanting, so that they were the ones being objective and he was the one introducing something to the text that wasn't there to begin with, but I think he was revealing what was there to begin with. He was the one being objective. I am the truth, the light, and the way. But it was their hardened hearts, which has this, what was called the noetic effects of sin. In other words, sin makes you stupid, so that you could be a really brilliant person, but because of your sinful inclinations, propositions that you should entertain as a fair-minded person, you won't even really be able to feel the weight of because of your sin, your prejudices.
How could God hold them guilty, though, if it was if this was their destiny and they're unable to correctly interpret the scriptures? I don't understand how. It's kind of like, well, hey, I couldn't do anything differently than I am, but that's not flying with Jesus. Matter of fact, that's why he said, woe to them, woe to you, because they were capable of looking into the scriptures and coming up with the significance of the teachings, and that they were literal, but yet they were far more than just literal. And he held them accountable to these things, that these should have known and been prepared, because, you know, one of the ways in which they constantly wanted to know, Jesus, quit talking in riddles to us. Are you the Messiah? And he was saying very clearly, I show you these signs. You admit that nobody can do these things unless it is God who enables them. And yet you don't believe me. Why? Because I tell you things that you misunderstood and you can't accept, even though the evidence of who I am is very clear by the nature and the character of God and the power that I demonstrate.
Right. Well, I think it's because they didn't walk in the light that they had. I mean, if you walk in the light that you have, you will be given more light. But if you choose to reject the light because you favor your sin and your hardness of heart and harbor hatred and unforgiveness or whatever, well, then you're getting away from the light. So the fact that you're misunderstanding things later actually is on you, because you rejected the light that you did have, and that hardened your heart, so that blinds your eyes.
Okay, I don't want to get bogged down with this, but I think that what I'm starting to see here is the deconstruction of the faith is something that is natural. It's something that we all need to do at some time. Now, the reason in which we deconstruct our faith has a lot to do with the outcome in which we will arrive at.
Exactly.
So if we want to deconstruct it because we don't like what it says in its teaching, even though it's pretty clear and objective, we just want to refute that so we can serve our own pleasure.
Right.
Then I think we're going to come to a place where we deconstruct our faith and throw it out or become very progressive and say, oh, well, they weren't enlightened enough and, you know, they didn't understand this, even though the text is pretty clear and straightforward.
Right. So yeah, it's very arrogant. I mean, I think there's so much going on. It's like, I think some people, when they're in this movement, it's because they're strictly political and they want to have their way because they're pursuing power. So Nietzsche's the will to power. They're evil and they're working with Satan to destroy people's faith. I think there are some people like that, but I think that there are some people who are, you know, like what I was saying earlier, they or like what you were just saying, they want to pursue their pleasures. This is getting in the way of that, so they're going to deny it because it makes them feel uncomfortable. And they're people who really, it's all about me, my happiness, my goals, because I'm a narcissist, and this doesn't make me feel good, so I'm going to attack it, deny it, and claim that I'm being liberated and free to be me, you be you, you know?
And now you're spiritual, right? It's not as though you've thrown off everything. You've only thrown off what you don't like and still can consider yourself a Christian or you're spiritual now. You're not held down by the bondages of religion. But God has been very good from the beginning, you know, of providing us in Scripture truth. And then definitely revelation through Jesus Christ and how he lived and his teachings only brought clarity to the teachings of the Old Testament. And that's what we have today. He's not sending any new prophets along the way to give us any new teaching. And we look at the church fathers and their understanding as they are the closest to, you know, the apostles and how they continue to, you know, express the teachings of Christ. So when we decompress, I want to go back to the scriptures because I think that the apostles themselves dealt with this very issue. I think they had a time where, you know, they started following Christ, believing that he was the Messiah, and then they started questioning, you know, is he really the Messiah? Why isn't he doing some of these things that we would expect him to do? And so they're starting to question. And then, matter of fact, after he makes a really difficult statement in the book of John, right? Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can't have any part to do with me. I mean, the disciples at that time started falling away.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that it's it depends on who you're dealing with. And like you were saying earlier, what are the motives? Because when it comes to the first two categories of people, the ones just deliberately wanting to destroy people's faith because they're simply out after their own political power, or those people who are so steeped into sin by their own choices that aren't able to think straight when it comes to things of God, when it comes to those things, I feel like it's don't throw your pearls before the swine. I mean, Jesus is in effect calling them pigs, and they're not worth the effort. So I think that there are those people like that, but then there are the people like you're going with now who are genuinely struggling. And I had that in my own life, you know, for about 9 months.
Is that it?
Well, I mean, periodically, of course, we all struggle here or there with this or that.
Let me come back to the apostles, and I'm going to come back to what you're going to say here.
Sure.
You know, and the idea that, you know, Judas being one eventually deconstructed his faith. Christ wanted to go in a particular way, and Judas, you know, most likely says, why are you going that way? Maybe I can force you to do what I want you to do.
Yeah.
So he betrayed Christ, right? Trying to force his hand. Mm. And so oftentimes, you know, we can find in the religious quarters, people wanting to do the same thing. Forcing God to turn his perspective to their own. And God says, no. He goes, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And Peter had a difficult time with that. He did the same thing. He said, listen, I'm willing to die for you. And I said, really, Peter, are you? but are you willing to live for me?
Mm-hmm.
Are you willing to live with ambiguity until it becomes clear to you?
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we talk about your personal experience, and I had a personal experience, of course, of deconstructing my faith, it's like I start to question God, not that he's God, but about some of his teachings so that he can help me to understand.
Well, yeah.
And some things I get an answer for, others you don't. You just still have to continue on in the course.
Right. Lord, I believe, help my unbelief.
Oh, my, yeah.
And that's a humble approach, and that's an engaged mind with the faith, and the Lord, he respects that, and he honors that, and he understands that. And that's very different than like those first two categories of people we were talking about.
So when you're talking about your personal experience of deconstructing your faith, why don't you go into that with a little more detail?
Well, I was an Assemblies of God associate pastor, youth pastor, just for a year. And I got contingently licensed with the Assemblies of God. So if I would have taken a church, I would have been a licensed minister. But I saw so many awful things in the church. With my pastor, I had a heart attack. And in that time, most of the board was really horrible to him. They were terrible. And so I get hit on one side with just seeing how awful the church can be, and
how
horrible Christians can be
with one another.
Yeah.
And is it a power grab?
Oh, yeah, it was. It was horrible. It was unfair. It was disgusting. I mean, my gosh, I knew atheists who treated people far better than that. And so there's that personal thing, which I think in a lot of people who are into deconstruction, so often I think if they scratch the surface, it's like, this isn't actually an intellectual thing with you at all. It kind of has an intellectual garb to it. That's the way you're communicating it. But that's not actually what's going on here. What's going on here is you got kicked in the head. You don't understand it. You have horrible grief, anger, unforgiveness. And so I did that. But at the same time, there was the intellectual component too, because I was taking philosophy classes, like Ramakrishna Pulagandli or Stephen Laycock, you know, a Hindu and a Buddhist. Brilliant men, you know, loved them both, loved their classes, learned a lot from them, got along great, had some good arguments. But anyway, you know, kind of introducing the concept of other religions. I mean, I was brought up as a Christian, so I think as a Christian, no kidding. You're brought up as a Hindu, you think as a Hindu. You're brought up as a Jewish person, and you've studied the Kabbalah, and so that's what you're into. No kidding. That's how you were raised.
So in other words, if you were thinking, if I understand you correctly, because I'm a Christian, raised in a Christian family, this is how I'm going to think, maybe I should consider how others might think.
Exactly.
If I
and worship.
And worship. So you started looking into other religions.
Right.
What did you conclude? What went on?
Well, at first, I actually thought, you know, entertained atheism, but that was only for a couple of weeks. Because, I mean, just intellectually, I think it's so stupid that...
I'm sure we have any atheists out there. They're going to love that comment.
I'm sorry. You know, I agree with the Psalms that they're fools. So, yeah, something comes from nothing, seriously. Or, you know, everything evolved according to the laws, wherever these laws came from. That's quite a problem of physics and chemistry and whatnot.
So intellectually, you were quickly able to dismiss that.
Yeah. So then I said, okay, fine. So I have to at least be agnostic, though. So, yes, of course there's a God. Of course there's a creator. I'm not an idiot. And I'm not going to, you know, throw my brain out just because I've had my heart hurt.
But did you get the right one? That's the question.
The right what?
The right God.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I thought, well, okay, I'm an agnostic then. So, you know what? Yes, of course, there's a God. But anyway, he doesn't have anything to do with me, obviously, because look at the mess I'm in and look at all I've gone through and look at how horrible this church is and this faith that supposedly he founded. Like, no way. This doesn't make sense.
So really what you're questioning, not the existence of God.
No.
You're questioning the existence of the Christian God
right.
that you had been taught and come to embrace.
Yeah, so I thought, no, he doesn't have anything to do, you know, with me. But, you know, you still have the yearnings of the heart. So I went into mysticism and, you know, reading Buddhism and Hinduism and Taoism and at least some vague understanding of being at peace with the universe or something, you know.
That'd be nice, right?
Yeah, of
having
course.
Peace. Isn't that what
you
really
peace?
We're looking for?
Yeah, instilling your mind and and being open, you know. So I guess this was about a 9-month venture. But anyway, then more and more I'm drawn into back into the Christian faith. And so I thought, well, what about people like Thomas Merton and the Seven Story Mountain and Christian mysticism? And which isn't so, to me, it seemed not so theological, a lot broader, not so rigid, fundamentalist-like. So anyway, I started reading, you know, then more Orthodox people, though, who were, I would call, mystical. Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, Bonaventure.
So are you on a quest right now for truth? Is that what you're looking for?
Well, I think we all are always,
so
I hope.
The difference is that this is a quest and not looking for an exit sign. Am I correct?
Yeah, not to have, you know, I mean, I think it's a healthy kind of thing. Jesus said, I would wish you'd be hot or cold, but as it is, I'm going to spew you out of my mouth. And so I think people who are really struggling, you know, for these personal reasons and these, oh, look at all the evil happening. I mean, how could this be? How could a God who knows everything and is able to stop it and loves everybody seriously, and yet this is going on, how could that be?
Good questions.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think the Lord honors that.
Do you have an answer for those?
We could end
this podcast right now. Never have another one if you can answer that question.
Thank you for spending time to listen to today's podcast, the first in the series, Deconstruction of the Faith. This is not the end of faith, but the building of a healthy faith. We hope you continue to tune in and don't drop out as we continue with conversations that make a difference in our lives. Until the next time, go out as God's ambassadors, commissioned to a world in need, in desperate need of the gospel. God bless.